From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Is this truly a humanitarian intervention? What is humanitarian? About providing to one side of the conflict the ability to wage war against the other side of a conflict, which will inevitably trigger a civil war, making all of Libya a graveyard.
Democratic Congress member Dennis Kucinich accuses President Obama of violating the War Powers Resolution by attacking Libya without congressional approval. He says the president's actions are impeachable. We'll also speak with the Ohio congressman about the anti-union bill Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich just signed into law last night. Then we turn to Ivory Coast, where heavy fighting's underway. Troops loyal to the rival of President Laurent Gbagbo have surrounded his presidential palace.
I think it would be premature and probably a little bit reckless for me to predict when Gbagbo will fall, whether it will be in the next several hours, the next several days, or the next several weeks. But it is absolutely clear that he is in a substantial and significantly weakened position.
And the 2012 presidential race is off and running. It'll be the most expensive campaign in history. Obama's hoping to raise $1 billion. We'll look at his campaign manager, Jim Messina. From his stance on health care to gay rights, he has many progressives deeply concerned. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Clashes are underway in Libya's eastern oil town of Brega as rebel fighters try to reverse the momentum of the forces loyal to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. The rebels are said to have made gains to retake Brega following a night of NATO airstrikes against Gaddafi's troops. Rebel groups, meanwhile, are accusing the Gaddafi regime of committing massacres in the town of Misurata, with shellings reportedly killing dozens of civilians in the past few days. A rebel spokesperson told Reuters at least 20 civilians were killed and many wounded when Gaddafi forces bombed a number of homes. The Western bombing campaign has also reportedly killed a number of civilians in recent bombings of the capital, Tripoli. A top Vatican official said he's heard credible reports new airstrikes have killed at least 40 civilians. The deputy commander of the NATO force, Canadian Lieutenant Charles Bouchard, said he's taking the reports seriously.
We are very careful in the prosecution of any of the possible targets that we have. We have very strict rules of engagement provided to us, and we are operating within the legal mandates of our United Nations Mandate 1973.
Testifying before Congress, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, said the Gaddafi regime's forces aren't near a breaking point despite being weakened by the bombing.
We have actually fairly seriously degraded his military capabilities, his air defense capabilities, his command and control capabilities. We've attrited his overall forces at about the 20 to 25% level. That doesn't mean that he's about to break from a military standpoint, because that's just not the case.
There's been speculation over whether rebel fighters will be able to defeat Gaddafi without an invasion by foreign troops. Appearing with Mullen, Defense Secretary Robert Gates reiterated vows not to send U.S. soldiers into Libya.
There will be no American boots on the ground in Libya. Deposing the Gaddafi regime, as welcome as that eventuality would be, is not part of the military mission. In my view, the removal of Colonel Gaddafi will likely be achieved over time through political and economic measures and by his own people.
While the Obama administration has not sent troops, CIA operatives are on the ground in Libya as part of a covert Western force aiding the bombing campaign. According to Reuters, CIA operatives were sent into Libya even before President Obama signed a secret order authorizing the covert mission. The Gaddafi regime continues to face reports of high-level defections. A number of regime figures, including the head of Libya's de facto parliament and a former prime minister, are said to have fled to neighboring Tunisia. Meanwhile, Libya's former foreign minister, Ali Trekki, said he'd turned down a request to represent Gaddafi regime at the United Nations. The Libyan government has apparently also asked Nicaragua's former foreign minister, Miguel Descoto Brockman, to serve at the UN on its behalf, but there's confusion around whether the request has been formalized. The news follows the defection of Libyan Foreign Minister Moussa Koussa, who is now in Britain after crossing over from Libya to Tunisia. A Gaddafi spokesperson confirmed Koussa's defection, but insisted the Libyan government remains intact.
They are here, they are doing their jobs. And if some of them left in the last few hours, maybe I did not hear about him leaving. You know, it would usually, you know, be on a mission, because we try to negotiate with the world. Our officials do travel daily, by the way, and they do come back daily, by the way.
The death toll from weeks of fighting in Libya is unknown, but it's believed thousands have been killed. Speaking in Cairo, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, appealed for humanitarian access to civilians victimized by the conflict.
I'd also would like to say how concerned we are with the humanitarian situation in Libya. There is a lot of discussion in the world, a lot of coverage of the military and the political aspect of the conflict, but very little attention to the humanitarian dramatic situation in the country.
Here at home, Ohio's Republican Governor John Kasich has signed into law a measure stripping public workers of collective bargaining rights and barring them from striking. The legislation will affect over 360,000 workers, making Ohio the biggest state so far to curb the rights of public sector employees. In addition to undoing collective bargaining, the law forces public workers to pay at least 15% of their health care premiums, removes automatic pay increases, and makes it more difficult for unions to collect dues. Opponents say they'll attempt to undo the law by putting it to a public referendum. Wisconsin Republicans have announced they'll stop trying to enforce their anti-union law following a judge's ruling it has not yet taken effect. On Thursday, Dane County Circuit Judge Marianne Sumi reinforced a temporary restraining order she'd initially issued last month blocking the measure's implementation. Judge Sumi had ruled Republican lawmakers were likely in violation of state open meeting laws when they pushed the legislation through. Earlier this week, Republicans and top state officials had said they would ignore the order and enforce the law's provisions. The anti-union push is being mirrored across the country. On Thursday, lawmakers in New Hampshire and Oklahoma advanced measures that would weaken public sector unions. Meanwhile, in Maine, Republican lawmakers are pushing two bills that would roll back parts of the state's child labor laws. The first measure would let employers pay workers under the age of 20 a full $2.25 less per hour than Maine's minimum wage for their first 180 days on the job. The bill would also eliminate the maximum number of hours a minor 16 years of age or older can work on a school day. The second measure would allow 16 and 17-year-olds to work an hour later on school nights. Talks continue on Capitol Hill over a budget agreement to avert a government shutdown. Senate Democrats have rejected a measure approved by the Republican-controlled to cut federal spending by $61 billion. This week, the Obama administration said Democrats and Republicans had agreed to cut $33 billion, which would be the largest one-time reduction in U.S. history. But on Thursday, Republican leaders say no commitments have been made. Republicans want to impose drastic cuts on longtime right-wing targets such as National Public Radio, Planned Parenthood, and the Environmental Protection Agency. Foreign aid would also take a significant hit. The nation's top foreign aid official is warning the Republicans' budget bill would lead to the deaths of 70,000 children who rely on U.S. assistance worldwide. Testifying before a House panel, USAID Administrator Rajiv Shah said the Republican measure, known as H.R. 1, would force cutbacks to spending on malaria control, immunizations and childbirth attendance. Shah called the 70,000 estimate a conservative figure. Displaced residents of areas near Japan's stricken Fukushima nuclear plant have been told their evacuation may last 4 months. Thousands of people have been living in temporary shelters since the earthquake and tsunami badly damaged the plant. The announcement comes as high levels of radiation have been found in groundwater near the plant for the first time. Radioactive iodine was found at 10,000 times the legal limit. The Japanese government, meanwhile, is reportedly considering using public funds to buy a controlling stake in the plant. Owner Tokyo Electric Power Company in order to exert greater control over the recovery effort. Ivory Coast leader Laurent Gbagbo is battling to remain in power as his rival Alassane Ouattara's forces surround the main city of Abidjan. Much of the fighting's concentrated around Gbagbo's heavily fortified presidential palace. On Thursday, Ouattara's Prime Minister Guillaume Soro said Gbagbo's days at the palace are numbered.
Gbagbo is finished. I don't know, but I'm not waiting for this ultimatum.
Okay.
Yes, we well organized, and we think that things are over now, and Gbagbo must resign himself.
We'll have more on the Ivory Coast later in the broadcast. Protests are continuing in Yemen against embattled U.S.-backed President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Thousands of people have flooded the streets of the capital, Sana'a, to honor the dozens of people killed in Saleh's crackdown on the uprising. Saleh has withdrawn an offer to step down by the end of the year following the collapse of talks with the opposition. At least six U.S. soldiers have been killed in eastern Afghanistan over the past 2 days. The Pentagon says the troops were part of the same operation, but were killed in three separate incidents. And a former manager at California's San Onofre nuclear power plant is suing the facility's owners for allegedly firing him in retaliation for reporting safety concerns. Paul Diaz says officials at Southern California Edison fired him shortly after the Nuclear Regulatory Commission ordered the company to address what it called, quote, a chilling effect on addressing workplace safety. Diaz's lawsuit says the NRC first investigated the plant after it received anonymous reports of infractions, including shortcuts on testing new generators, unreported safety violations, falsifying records, promoting a culture of cover-up, and ignoring chronic fatigue amongst overburdened workers. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show on Libya. The White House is refusing to confirm a report that President Obama has signed a secret order authorizing covert U.S. government support for rebel forces seeking to oust Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. According to the Reuters news agency, Obama signed the order, known as a presidential finding, within the last 2 or 3 weeks. Earlier this week, the New York Times revealed CIA operatives are already on the ground in Libya as part of a covert Western force to aid the U.S.-led bombing campaign. In Washington, the president's war plans are continuing to come under criticism by some members of Congress. On Thursday, Ohio Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich gave a 40-minute address on the floor of the House. He accused President Obama of violating the War Powers Resolution by attacking Libya without congressional approval. Congressman Kucinich has also suggested the president's actions are an impeachable offense.
Congressman Dennis Kucinich joins us now in Washington, D.C., to talk about Libya, as well as the latest news from his home state of Ohio, where, well, last night, Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich signed a bill that strips collective bargaining rights for state employees and bars them from striking. Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, welcome to Democracy Now! Let's start with Libya. Lay out your thesis that you put forward on the floor of the House yesterday.
Simply put, the president has no constitutional authority to do what he's done. He has changed the Constitution, in effect, by saying that he has an executive privilege to wage war. He's ignored Article 1, Section 8. He's ignored the War Powers Act. He's even exceeded the U.N. mandate. And so this administration has taken this country on a path that is profoundly anti-democratic, and it needs to be challenged.
And Congressman, when you say an impeachable offense, those are pretty strong words.
Well, actually, what I've said is that he's exceeded his authority as executive, and I raised the question as to whether or not, when someone does that, if that, in fact, is an impeachable offense. Look, there's not going to be an impeachment, but someone has to say that what the president is doing is fundamentally wrong. If we have any understanding of the way this country was founded, the founders did not want to create in the executive another British king who could wage war at his whim and caprice. This president has assumed power that no president, not even President Bush, has assumed. And I think that we need to focus on this, not as a matter of whether we like President Obama or not, not as a matter of whether we are Democrats or not, but whether or not we understand the basic constitutional principles of the separation of power, the separation of the war power, and that the president's role as commander-in-chief has nothing to do with an ability to make war. He just simply doesn't have that power.
What about President Obama's argument when he made his case to the nation that he was trying to prevent a massacre and that it would have been wrong not to take action with the world community?
Well, we don't know what exactly was going on in Libya, because the fact is that when a U.N. commission of inquiry went in, they had to quickly leave because the bombing had started. The fact that the leader of that country made threats to do something, you know, this wasn't a basis for the United States to assume that we had the right to go in and start to provide the rebels with air cover. I mean, this thing has leapfrogged from, quote, humanitarian intervention, which inevitably is taking the side of the rebels, so we're helping to fulminate a civil war, into a full-scale military operation, which, you know, it seems was the real intention all along. So we really have some serious questions to ask of this administration and Congress, if Congress is to mean anything at all with respect to our historic responsibilities as the first among equals in our Constitution. We have the obligation to call this administration to an accounting and not just be supplicants to the power of a president who is now starting to act like something that's beyond what the Constitution envisioned.
Well, Congressman, but the reality is, in terms of the recent U.S. history especially, there have been any number of U.S. interventions in countries where they stopped short of a full-fledged war, but the president, for one reason or another, didn't feel it was necessary before sending troops into the field to request the vote of Congress. Your sense of how the War Powers Act has evolved in the United States in recent years?
Well, there's a couple issues here. First of all, what other presidents have done? You know, frankly, that's neither here nor there. If there's an argument that, well, Congress didn't assert its authority before, and so what's happened is that we—I think Glenn Greenwald argued this as well in a recent column—it doesn't follow that the consistent acquiescence to an executive usurpation of congressional power nullifies the founding document. It doesn't. At some point, you have to say, wait a minute here. And so that's what I'm doing. Now, to look at the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 8 firmly defined the war power. You read the sense of Washington and Jefferson. You read the Federalist Papers, number 69, what Hamilton wrote about it. It makes it clear. That's what the war powers is. Now, the War Powers Act was an attempt to define better the relationship between Congress and the presidency by, you know, carving out circumstances under which the president can take action before going to Congress and providing for notification later on. The president has not met the requirements of the War Powers Act with respect to that, in terms of the definition of there being an attack on the United States, or the threat of one. So this is a circumstance where this administration is redefining the presidency in the same way that John Yoo, the attorney for President Bush, redefined it. We've got a presidency here that is becoming to be, is beginning to be indistinguishable from that of the Bush White House with respect to its use of war power, with respect to its interpretation of executive power, with respect to the role of the president in defining all national security issues without consulting with Congress at all.
What do you think President Obama should do in Libya and then Yemen, for example? I mean, we have to look at all of these countries in Tunisia, in Egypt, Yemen, where the U.S. has supported these dictators, these despots, for decades. But what should the U.S. do in Libya? And then what about Yemen, where the U.S. continues to support Saleh?
Well, there's two things here, Amy. One is what we should have done, and number two is where we are now. we have no right to intervene in the internal affairs of any country. It is awful anytime people are suffering under a bad leader. And it's awful when there's violence. You can never condone that. On the other hand, as Noam Chomsky famously pointed out, humanitarian war is an oxymoron. Inevitably, it expands to engulf citizens. We're involved in a breeding civil war here that inevitably is going to make of Libya a graveyard. We need to pull back. We need to get out. Now, having disturbed things like this, it means that there would be profound consequences for the people that took that on whose side we've intervened. And it would be profound consequences for the CIA that's been on the ground there. But the fact of the matter is, we had no right going in there. And let's go beyond Libya. If we start intervening for humanitarian purposes throughout the region, we're looking at feeding this impulse of war. We could be on the verge of a war that is so broad that we become engulfed in it. And that's really, I think, what we're headed for, because the Obama administration is not showing the kind of restraint that the people have a right to expect in a president of the United States, and is not showing the willingness to recognize the constitutional role of the Congress. And if you do not have Congress as a co-equal branch of government, then you have an executive who's quite free to pursue adventures in his name and not in the name of the country.
Congressman Kucinich, I want to ask you about the latest news from your state of Ohio. Last night, Republican Governor John Kasich signed a bill that strips collective bargaining rights for state employees and bars them from striking. And Democrats have announced plans to collect more than 230,000 signatures to block immediate implementation of the bill and place it on the November ballot. Your reaction to this action in your own state, and also to this growing trend among Republican legislatures around the country to begin stripping and limiting the bargaining rights of public employees?
Well, there's two things that are happening here, at least. One is the attack on public employees. But the attack on public employees really presages an attack on the entire public sphere. So what's happening here is a destructive undermining of the principle of government of the people, and that people have a right to have schools they can call their own, energy systems they can call their own, public services they can call their own. The attack on public servants opens the door to a broad-scale theft of the public domain. And so this is about privatization writ large. It's about attempting to create circumstances where the physical assets of the state that were purchased through people's tax dollars over many generations are about to be auctioned off, often to a lower bidder, in order for the private sector to profit. And the attack on workers here is fundamentally anti-American. In a democratic society, workers have to have a right to organize, a right to collective bargaining, a right to strike, a right to decent wages and benefits, a right to a secure retirement, a right to safe workplace. These are all things that should be guaranteed in a democratic society. And Governor Kasich has unfortunately joined the ranks of other Republican governors who are involved in this broad attack on workers' rights, which is profoundly anti-democratic.
Well, what about this movement for putting it on the ballot that would require hundreds of thousands of signatures? I mean, about 250,000, but they'd need much more because they'd all have to be valid. And then the issue of Ohio, such an essential state when it comes to the presidential election in 2012. 360,000 public workers affected. The Wisconsin protests were massive, but Ohio is so significant when it comes to the union movement. It has the nation's sixth largest number of public sector union members, which is twice as many as Wisconsin. How are you organizing around this?
Well, I've been working with labor unions across the state. I've met with leaders of state labor. I've been with the workers outside the state house. I've been rallying with them across Ohio. I understand that this is that we are at the threshold of a whole new world here, where workers are either going to be restored to a position of dignity in our society, or they're going to be reduced to a second-class citizenship. Of course, I support the attempt to create to repeal this bill. I believe that the unions and their supporters will gain the necessary signatures to get this on the ballot. But we have to understand the thinking that's behind this, Senate Bill 5. And the thinking is that there is no such thing as government of the people. This idea of government of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations has actually taken hold. It's taken hold in a Citizens United case. It's taken hold in Buckley versus Vallejo. And now it's taken hold with Senate Bill 5.
Well, one of the interesting aspects is there's quite a few in the bill that was passed would be that union members would be the governments, local governments would be prohibited from collecting the voluntary political donations of workers to the political funds of their unions. This seems to be a direct attempt to prevent the unions from being able to develop political war chests. Before the upcoming elections, obviously before the upcoming presidential elections. Your response to that?
I would think that, it's unconstitutional. I mean, it's actually trying to intervene in the right of association. And there are free speech implications here. But, you know, when you're talking about corporate interests running a state, what's a constitution among friends? You have to look at the attempt here to destroy unions. That's exactly what it is. And at this point, unions are one of the last lines of defense against a corporate plutocracy. And so we really have to support the workers in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, and everywhere across this country, they're under attack. And I believe most strongly that this is one of the fundamental issues of our time with respect to economic justice. This is the new civil rights movement in America, the right to restore the dignity of workers, the right to protect their social and economic, the obligation to protect their social and economic rights.
Do you feel you're getting the support from the Obama administration, that the unions are getting the support that President Obama promised when he was a senator, saying if any collective bargaining rights were threatened, he'd have his shoes on marching with them in the streets?
Well, he hasn't found those shoes yet, but I'm sure he'll find them. I think that we have a right to expect a president who was elected with the help of working men and women, not to say, I stand behind you, but to stand at the forefront to defend workers' rights. One of the things that I'm concerned about with respect to this particular White House is what seems to be the extraordinary influence that Wall Street has. We could not have, 14, 15 million people out of work unless there are those who are helping to manage the engines of this economy who feel that, well, to have that level of unemployment is somehow conducive to the to a functioning of the economy in order to keep the cost of labor low. We really have to demand that our president, and he is our president, step forward here and defend workers and not just, give us platitudes, but be there, be forward with defending them, using the Justice Department, using his bully pulpit to step forward, to join workers at state capitals, to rally people on this issue, to stand with them and support Senate Bill the repeal of Senate Bill 5, to stand with the workers in Wisconsin and Michigan, to take a stand against this attempt to privatize wholesale the assets of state and local governments. In some cases, you have an attempt, as in Michigan, to write laws that would even lead to the abolition of local governments and taken over by an unelected board. I mean, this is a moment where we have to decide if we have a democracy and if we have a president who's going to defend it.
Well, Dennis Kucinich, we thank you very much for being with us, a Democratic congressmember from Ohio, from Cleveland. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. And we just got this message from Sharifa Bokadous that Mohamed Radwan has reportedly been set free. He's the Egyptian-American we have been following in Syria, who was taken by the Syrian security forces, according to a tweet from his cousin, who said, confirmed, he has been released. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. You can see Sharif's interview with him when he was in Tahrir Square at democracynow.org. Stay with us.
salam, love, salam alaikum, Africa, salam. Salam alaikum, Africa, Bola, Medina, salam, salam, salam.
Salam alaikum, Africa, salam.
Salam alaikum, Africa, salam.
I'm gonna do what the Sally gave.
Assalamu alaikum, Africa, by Francis Kingsley and Emmy Tass. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, in the West African nation of Ivory Coast, fighting has erupted in the country's main city of Abidjan after supporters of the internationally recognized President Alassane Ouattara entered the city Thursday in an attempt to depose incumbent Laurent Gbagbo, who has refused to cede power after the disputed election. Some of the heaviest fighting has been outside Gbagbo's presidential palace. France's ambassador to Ivory Coast says that Gbagbo has fled his Abidjan compound and is nowhere to be found. Forces loyal to Ouattara have also seized control of the country's state television. Earlier this week, they took control of the country's capital, Yamoussoukro, and the cocoa port of San Pedro with little resistance. French soldiers have also been deployed in Abidjan to protect foreign residents. The United Nations says Gbagbo lost a run for re-election last November to Ouattara, but he has so far refused to cede power. Earlier today, the African Union urged Gbagbo to immediately hand over power. Some police units and the head of the army have defected from the embattled leader. On Thursday, Ouattara called for the country's military to join his forces.
Aujourd'hui, elles sont aux portes d'Abidjan.
Today, they are at the doorsteps of Abidjan. To all those who are still hesitating, whether you are generals, superior officers, officers, under officers, rank and file soldiers,
sous-officiers, militaires du rang, je vous demande de vous mettre à la disposition.
I ask you to put yourself at the disposal of your country and thereby return to legality. There is still time to join your brothers in arms, the Republican forces. The country calls you.
Le pays vous appelle.
Alassane Ouattara's forces are estimated to control as much as 80% of the Ivory Coast. To discuss the situation there, we're joined on the phone by Corinne Dufka, senior researcher in the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. She's joining us from Dakar, Senegal. And in Washington, D.C., we're joined by Naka Lagoke, an Ivory Coast political analyst. He runs the website AfricanDiplomacy.com. We're going to go first to Corinne Dufka. Describe what you understand is happening now on the ground, what you are most concerned about.
Yes, good day to everyone. Yes, we understand the situation is very, very tense indeed in Abidjan. This is the culmination of a four-month-long crisis in which we have seen atrocities of the worst kind being committed in Abidjan, primarily by militias and those allied to Laurent Gbagbo. We understand the fighting is concentrated around the presidential palace as well as around the presidential residence. And around a key gendarme camp in a place called Agban, where some people think the president and his allies, the former president and his allies, may be. We were primarily concerned that as the Ouattara's forces flooded into Abidjan, that the militias allied to Gbagbo, who have over the last several months been committing awful killings and so on, primarily against those real and perceived supporters of Ouattara, would begin to conduct very massive atrocities. That appears not to have happened simply because I think the pace at which Ouattara's offensive occurred has left them either fleeing or has pushed them into their places of concentration to defend themselves. We also understand that there have been some reprisal killings in the west, which recently fell to Ouattara's forces. We yesterday denounced a massacre by Gbagbo's forces, including Liberian mercenaries of some 40 West Africans, primarily Malians and Burkinabes. Also, our team in the border area in Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire, have recently documented about 8 killings by Ouattara's forces. So a very, very tense situation indeed.
And Corinne Dovka, the reaction of the international community, given all of the attention that the popular uprisings in northern Africa have received and the repression of those authoritarian governments there, how do you assess the reaction of the international community to what is going on in the Ivory Coast?
Well, it was quite disappointing, to be honest. We felt that there wasn't enough attention given to the very serious human rights abuses, which we have characterized could very well rise to the level of crimes against humanity. The United Nations estimates some 500 people have been killed in the last 4 months. We didn't see until quite recently a strong enough reaction on the part of the Security Council, although European Union and the United States did initiate some sanctions against Gbagbo and his people.
On Wednesday, the UN Security Council voted to impose sanctions on Gbagbo and his inner circle, as you've said. In a unanimous vote, the council authorized travel restrictions and an asset freeze on Gbagbo, his wife, and three close associates. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, praised the vote.
The resolution sends a strong signal. Mr. Gbagbo and his followers should immediately reject violence and respect the will of the Ivorian people. As violence continues, Côte d'Ivoire stands at a crossroads. Mr. Gbagbo and his supporters can continue to cling to power, which will only lead to more innocent civilians being wounded and killed, and more diplomatic and economic isolation. Or Mr. Gbagbo and his followers can finally reject violence and respect the will of the Ivorian people. If this path is chosen, Ivorians can reclaim their country and rebuild a vibrant economy that was once the admiration of all of Africa.
That was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, talking about Côte d'Ivoire in English, Ivory Coast. Naka Lagoke, also with us, a political analyst, runs AfricanDiplomacy.com. Your response to the situation there, what the U.N. has done and what you feel needs to be done.
Oh, thank you very much, Amy Goodman, and thank you for having me back on your show. The reality on the ground is very, very serious and very complicated. Alassane Dramane Ouattara's forces, as we know, have been progressing and taking cities, you know, from the central part of the country to the western part of the country, and now they are in Abidjan, trying to dislodge Gbagbo or try to kill Gbagbo Laurent. I know that Gbagbo's forces have committed some human rights violations, but I'm surprised that all that noise is made about Gbagbo's people killing innocent people in the Ivory Coast, and people are not putting emphasis on the Alassane Ouattara's people who have been committing many violations in the western part of the country, and they have killed civilians in different parts of the country. The United Nations is involved in the crisis, and they decided to become a kingmaker. And at the same time, the UN and the French forces—that's the reality on the ground—they are backing the Alassane Ouattara's forces, and they are giving them a strategic support with their warplanes. And there are even people there are witnesses who are saying that they have seen French soldiers shooting at Gbagbo soldiers. This is also the reality on the ground.
Now, you have raised in the past questions about how the international community has dealt with the entire process, even the conclusion as to who won the recent election. Could you expound on that?
Yeah, of course. When I came here, when I was given the opportunity by Amy, I said that at that time that I did not know who won the election. I still believe that it is not clear. And later on, I found some evidence. A communique from the United Nations, a report from France 24, all of them, they said that the participation rate at the election could not go beyond 70%. When the president of the Electoral Commission announced Alassane Ouattara the winner of the election, they announced that the participation rate was 81%. This is not possible because Ivorian did not go out to vote massively during the runoff. Now, Instead of trying to find a way to solve the situation, the United Nations has taken side, and the President of the United States, for whom I have a great respect and great admiration, he played his card too soon, And then, of course, you know, they decided, you know, to opt for a military intervention. And we can see that Ivorians are dying in the country. And even the economic sanctions, they did not spare the Ivorians, Ivorian people, irrespective of their political affiliation, irrespective of their ethnicity, irrespective of their religion, because people don't have access to the medication because of the embargo, and people don't have access to the saving and the money in the account, and the international community is not talking about all those things. And that's my role, to try and bring something, you know, other people are not talking about.
Corinne Dufka, your response to what Naka Lagoki is saying.
Well, first of all, former President Gbagbo agreed to allow the United Nations to certify the results of those elections. They were massively monitored. The United Nations certified the results of the elections, which were then backed up by the European Union, the African Union, the regional body ECOWAS, bilaterally, of course, by most nations. So I think his position is certainly a minority report. Now, in terms of the violations, we also have documented some violations by Ouattara, but I could say that the vast majority of them, certainly in the capital Abidjan, have been committed by those forces allied to Gbagbo, and Gbagbo has done absolutely nothing to rein in the militias, to rein in and try to control state-controlled media who have been inciting forces to commit acts, and certainly has done nothing to investigate or hold those responsible. I personally have documented 20 cases of Malians, Burkinabes, Northern Ivorians who have been pulled from their cars or stopped at checkpoints manned by militiamen, hacked to death, burned alive, and so on, in addition to 20 cases of women who have been motivated by militiamen and members of the security forces. We're saying that all sides to this conflict now must abide by international humanitarian law, and we're warning against reprisal killings that could take place in the future.
And Corinne Dufka, what about the allegation of Naka Lagoki in terms of the role of the French and of French soldiers in the country?
Well, former President Gbagbo has tried to put this in terms of, a dynamic of being sort of formal colonialist and so on. The French peacekeepers are there. They have been part of the United Nations peacekeeping mission. They are patrolling. They have, over the last several days, rescued a number of foreigners, European Union and others who have come under threat. They have about 500 of them now in their base. We spoke with civilians who have felt reassured by the French and UN presence, because they are patrolling in neighborhoods that have been vulnerable to this kind of abuse. But this is very much an Ivorian problem. We don't see it as being a problem of France or the United Nations trying to impose a leader. Rather, again, former President Gbagbo agreed to allow the United Nations to certify the results of those elections, and that's what they did.
And Corinne Dufka, the significance of Ivory Coast in the region.
Yes, Ivory Coast for many, 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 many years was the economic powerhouse of the region. And in many ways, the economic success of Ivory Coast was in part due to the work of West African laborers from Burkina Faso, Mali, Senegal, all over, really, who helped raise the economic status of that country to be the largest, rather, exporter of cacao. And the largest economy in French-speaking West Africa. So it's a very important economy. And, in the last 10 years, we've tragically seen rule of law deteriorate. And, of course, the once solid standing, economic standing of the country and lifestyle as well deteriorate.
And Naka Lagoki, how do you see this crisis being resolved? Do you think that Gbagbo will have to go, or what are the solutions do you envision?
At this moment, I don't know how, because if Gbagbo should have gone, maybe before the war, but he decided to stay, because there are many people who believe that, he should stay, to continue the struggle for sovereignty, while other people think that it is a matter of democracy. And so I think that the winner of the fight of the war or the civil war is going to become, the ruler of the country. But I can tell you that it's going to be difficult for either Gbagbo Laurent or Alassane Ouattara to rule that country. And one thing I just wanted to say to, the lady who was talking about Gbagbo Laurent, in Ivory Coast, it is not a matter of angel or demon or somebody who is a hero and somebody who is a villain. Alassane Dramane Ouattara has funded the rebellion. He has created a civil war in the country in 2002. And as we speak, people don't want to look at facts. His forces are the ones that have attacked Gbagbo's forces. And then I'm surprised that most of the killing that have been reported by the international community is like most of the time is about Gbagbo's people killing people. So in Ivory Coast, both of them are tragic heroes, and they are in the central part of the tragedy of the country. And I think that this is what people should look at. Talking about the French, yes, Amy.
Go ahead.
Yeah, talking about the French. People keep saying that there is not a neocolonial aspect of the crisis. That's ridiculous, because the French French people have colonized Ivory Coast. They are particularly involved, in the crisis in Ivory Coast. And then when they say that they're protecting civilians, you will see that those people have been giving a support to Alassane Dramane's forces. So even if it is under the umbrella of the United Nations, when you see a former colonial master involved in an internal crisis of a country taking side against a president just because they think that they don't control him, we call that neocolonialism. There is not an ideal way to describe that situation.
Finally, Corinne Dufka, the platform of Ouattara and the allegation that Naka Lugoki is making of it was Ouattara who attacked.
Yes. Well, first of all, he's absolutely right that there are no angels, as he said. Côte d'Ivoire has extremely serious problems when it comes to the rule of law. Indeed, there is really a crisis of impunity that has been deepening in the last 10 years. And during the armed conflict that he referred to in 2000 and 2003, both sides committed extremely serious abuses. So when Alassane Ouattara, if Alassane Ouattara indeed takes over the reins of the political reins of the country, he will inherit extremely serious problems, economic problems, problems with disarmament, which should have happened many months ago, as well as these rule of law problems in the key rule of law sectors, the police, the judiciary, accountability, and so on. So these will be extremely pressing challenges that he will step up to the plate and have to begin addressing right away, starting with having an absolute zero policy towards any kinds of reprisal killings against those who were allied with Gbagbo.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Corinne Dufka, Human Rights Watch, Africa Division, and Naka Lugoki, Ivory Coast political analyst, are running the website africandiplomacy.com in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we look at President Obama's campaign manager, Jim Messina. Why are progressives so deeply concerned? Stay with us.
inside before you check out your mind. I know we've all got problems. That's why I'm here to say, keep peace with me and I with you. Let me love in my own way.
Curtis Mayfield here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Republicans and Democrats are already gearing up for the 2012 election, which is expected to be the most expensive in history. The 2008 election set new records for campaigns. It was the longest at 22 months and the most expensive at $1.7 billion. Obama is expected to formally kick off his reelection bid on April 14th. His campaign expects to raise as much as $1 billion overall. Aggressive fundraising is now underway, including large, low-dollar events in several cities, alongside exclusive gatherings that will cost as much as $35,800 to attend. To handle his reelection effort, Obama has appointed Jim Messina as campaign manager. The move disappointed progressive observers, given Messina's links to corporate America and more conservative elements in the Democratic Party. Known as Obama's enforcer, Messina has also clashed with progressives on issues like health care reform and gay rights.
Ari Berman has written an article in The Nation magazine profiling Jim Messina, explaining why Messina will lead a very different campaign than 2008. Ari Berman joins us now. Well, tell us who Jim Messina is. Give us his background.
Well, White House Communications Director Dan Pfeiffer calls him the most powerful man in Washington you haven't heard of. And progressives are worried about him based on his background and his actions in the White House. For a very long time, he worked for Max Baucus, the senator of Montana, chairman of the powerful Senate Finance Committee, who was one of the most conservative Democrats in the Senate. After working for Baucus, he briefly joined the Obama campaign as the campaign's chief of staff, then went to work for Rahm Emanuel in the White House, was deputy chief of staff, the same position Karl Rove held for some time, the same position Josh Lyman held on the West Wing for some cultural observers. And really, during that time, he was thought of as first Rahm's enforcer. Then when Rahm went to Chicago to become mayor, Messina really took on the role of Rahm. And during that time, he was the top liaison to progressive groups on issues like health care, on issues like gay rights. And his tenure, from my reporting, was really marked by his clashes with those progressive activists. He was supposed to be working with them, but often was instead at odds with him. And that's why Obama supporters that I talked to are worried about his elevation as campaign manager for 2012.
And with these progressive groups, there was a weekly meeting, or every Tuesday, Common Purpose. Could you talk about how Messina dealt with that group and what it is? Because most people across the country don't even have never heard of it.
Yeah, there was this group set up called the Common Purpose Project, which really was supposed to be the gathering where administration officials would brief progressive groups, big progressive groups like MoveOn.org, labor unions, AFL-CIO, SEIU, Planned Parenthood. All the gamut of progressive groups in Washington, inside and outside of Washington, would be at these meetings, and there was supposed to be a back and forth.
And they'd meet every Tuesday?
They'd meet every Tuesday evening at the Capitol Hilton in Washington. But what Messina did is he really tightly controlled the discussions, and it was very much a one-way mode of doing business, where he said, this is the strategy, go support it. And what it was supposed to be a back and forth. And there was supposed to be outside mobilization by progressive groups on things like health care, on things like gay rights. That was the whole purpose of the Common Purpose Project. But really what happened is Messina and the White House, Rahm and other people, demobilized these progressive groups, took them out of the equation on things like health care, didn't want them talking about a public option, didn't want them criticizing Max Baucus. That had a very detrimental effect when the Tea Party exploded and there was all this mobilization on the right and none on the progressive side.
And he would threaten to not to disinvite you if you didn't go along with the program?
Absolutely. I mean, to be at these meetings, you had to be in line. You had to be with the administration. If you weren't, you would not be invited or you'd be excommunicated. It was very much a take-no-prisoners style. Messina has a take-no-prisoners style. The problem is the people he's often taking prisoner are Democratic activists and grassroots organizers, and that's why Obama supporters are worried about his role in 2012.
Talk about bundling. Talk about the large donors and what Messina is doing right now.
Well, if you look at the Obama campaign in 2008, what made it interesting was the fact that they raised all this money from small donors. Now, obviously, they raised a lot of money from large donors, but they also raised a very significant amount from small donors. Thus far in the Obama campaign, Messina has basically been going around the country on a listening tour of large donors. That's been his exclusive focus thus far. And it's really a very different playbook. I mean, the Obama 2012 campaign, to me, right now, looks a lot more like the Clinton campaign in 96 or the Bush campaigns in 2000 and 2004, which is raise a lot of money from large large donors, raise a lot of money from corporate America, lock these people down first, and build your campaign that way. That was not the Obama model in 2008, and I think that's another thing that people are wondering about. Where is the role for the small donors in here? Where is the role for the Obama activists in this equation? How are they going to be involved in a meaningful way in this campaign? Really, what Messina is doing is he's following the Max Baucus playbook. Baucus routinely raised among the most money from special interests and had the most lobbyists on K Street of any senator for a very long time.
And is the feeling of the Obama campaign already that the enthusiasm that generated all those small donors over the internet in the first campaign is not going to be here the second time around?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It certainly faded in 2010. We saw that Democratic activists did not turn out like Republican activists turned out. There has been an explosion in some of the Democratic grassroots in states like Wisconsin and Ohio, but that has very little to do with the Obama administration. So there definitely is a feeling among Obama supporters that they need to be reactivated, they need to be brought in at a meaningful way and not just be looked at as window dressing on this campaign in 2012. Thus far, that has not happened, really, in any meaningful way.
New York Times saying the nation's top Democratic contributors were given an ambitious set of marching orders on Thursday, yesterday, with a select group of 450 donors each asked to raise $350,000 before the end of the year. If all members meet their goal, the tally from this one group alone would be $157 million. A new goal will be set next year, expected to be much higher.
Well, the Obama campaign wants to raise $1 billion for this campaign. And in these events, you know, they're not public. The names are not released. We don't know who these donors are. We don't know what promises are being made. Maybe they're all just doing it out of the goodness of their own heart. But my feeling is if you got all these donors in a room, it would be a very different configuration of people than all the small donors who helped power the Obama campaign in 2008.
Talk about other groups and issues that you have raised deep concerns about Jim Messina and the direction. Of course, it's not Jim Messina. It's President Obama's choice for the direction he wants to go. That's how why he appoints this, what you call enforcer.
You mean the groups that have raised questions about him? Well, if you just look at my article, I mean, the people that talk about him were activists on health care reform, for example, big groups like Health Care for America Now, the major progressive groups. I mean, they were supposed to work with Messina, and they had a lot of problems with him. Groups on gay rights, a major gay rights blogger, Joe Sudbay for America Blog, basically said under Rahm and Messina, the White House suffered from political homophobia. They were afraid to do gay issues in politics, and it was only towards the very, very, very end of the lame duck Congress, after this tax cut deal enraged liberal Democrats, that repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell became a major victory for the administration and a priority for them. So there's sort of this revisionist history going on with regards to Messina. His allies say, oh, he's been fighting for progressive politics all along. Look at all the stuff that he's got done. And the groups that I talk to who worked with him say, no, 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 no. He was an obstacle along the way, over and over and over again, and we accomplished a lot of these things in spite of him. So this debate is going on right now to claim Messina's legacy and to wonder who's he going to represent on the Obama campaign in 2012.
His relationship with Wall Street?
He has a very close relationship with Wall Street. He organized a lot of these fundraising events that Baucus did. I mean, Baucus was chairman of the Finance Committee, raised a lot of money from Wall Street. Messina would frequently travel to New York to arrange these meetings that Baucus had. They would have these very lavish fundraising junkets out in Montana that Messina would organize. When Baucus kicked off his reelection campaign, he asked 50 lobbyists to raise $100,000 each for his campaign. And one lobbyist who attended said it was the most blunt message he'd ever received from a senator. So Baucus was almost exclusively going the corporate top dollar route, and that's what Messina was doing for him in part.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Ari Berman, for joining us. The piece is called Jim Messina, Obama's Enforcer. He writes for The Nation magazine, an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His book is called Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Has two job openings, looking for an experienced Ruby on Rails developer and for a multimedia producer. Go to our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Aaron Mate, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Shea. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.